is on.
Introducing Pretty Girls Love Real Estate. Stories of everyday women breaking barriers and building wealth through real estate.
Skinny Boss. B-O-S-S.
Hello, hello. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Pretty Girls Love Real Estate podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Washington, and I am super excited for my guest today. I have Miss Victoria Goose. She is the managing director at A. Walker & Co., and they're a boutique private equity firm based out of New York. So I'm really excited about talking to her about all the projects she's working with, all her vast experience in the private equity world. But before we get to that, Victoria, how are you?
I am doing great. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. I'm really happy for you to be here as well. I can't wait to get into this conversation. I think this might end up being one of my favorite episodes.
Bring it on. Good.
All right. So first and foremost, how did you first get into real estate?
Well, it's an interesting story. I got started in real estate when I was in college. I was a working college student. I was commuting from where I lived in Brooklyn to the Bronx. I went to Fordham University. And, you know, like a lot of other people, I had to pay my way through college. And so I needed to work. I had a lot of things going on. So I had a friend who introduced me to a nonprofit called Settlement Housing Fund. Mm-hmm. And a woman named Carol Lamberg and Susan Cole hired me to be an affordable housing coordinator. And at the time, I didn't know what that meant, but I knew that I could work in the city and do something really fun with a friend of mine. So we picked it up, and my job was really to, you know, process low-income housing applications in log number and sit down and interview applicants and qualify them and go through their income and their bank statements and guide them through the process until they got to leasing. And all of that just kind of led me to ask more questions. I was like, wait a minute. So if you get qualified for this program, you get to move into this luxury building mm-hmm. on the east side of Manhattan on 40th Street, and you pay $500 in rent. How is this even possible? So this was the first time I started asking questions about how does affordable housing get done? Mm-hmm. And these projects were called 80-20 developments in New York. It's 80% luxury market rate, 20% affordable, usually under the low-income housing tax credit program. Mm-hmm. And there would be a lot of applicants. You know, in the beginning, it was like, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 applicants for like 20, 30, 40 apartments. It grew to a lot more afterwards. But that was really my start, just kind of, you know, my first job, learning about it, and then just having more questions and being more interested in it. It was extremely complex. There were a lot of parties involved, and I just wanted to do more and more. So from that position, I went on to work at Related, and sort of the rest is history.
Yes, absolutely. So you talked about Related. You worked at a number of other, like, I guess, brand name, household name, affordable housing and market rate institutions. Tell me about maybe a project you worked on at any one of those that kind of stood out for you.
Oh, there are so many good ones over the years. But I think one that really stuck out to me was a project called Hunters Point South. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the Long Island City neighborhood in New York?
Yeah, a little bit, only to the extent that I know, you know, Amazon, that was a highly controversial yes. situation that happened there with them.
Yes, that shows you how the neighborhood changed over the years that Amazon was considering having their headquarters there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, back in the early 2000s, Long Island City was just kind of like a wasteland. There really wasn't anything there. It was mostly old warehouses and an old industrial site. There were abandoned warehouses there. And the city decided that they wanted to really transform this neighborhood and turn it into just sort of a new neighborhood, large scale redevelopment.
Right.
They sort of cut it up into multiple sites. And the first of these sites was RFP'd out, and the winner was Related, Phipps Houses, and Monadnock as a team. This was in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
In 2013, construction started, and I got involved in the project probably about 2014 or so. But it was really a transformative project. It was the first set of buildings in an entirely new neighborhood. It was 925 units. It was the largest workforce housing project in New York at the time. And the income limits went as low as 40% of AMI, all the way up to 230% of AMI across two buildings.
Wow.
They built a brand new park that overlooked the east side of Manhattan. There was a new 1,000-plus seat middle school and high school. So, and 17,000 square feet of retail. But really, it was like the bones of a brand new neighborhood. And mm-hmm. I think the city just RFP'd out today, 2023, the last of these sites. And, you know, this project had a huge impact on me because I really saw firsthand the kind of living and the kind of quality of life that people can afford to have if all the parties involved put all their resources together to put together a great project.
Mm-hmm.
There was tax credit involved. There was subsidies from the city involved. There was private, you know, capital involved. There was a nonprofit involved, tax exemptions. But it really made like a really beautiful product available to the everyday person.
Right.
I think most people would need to be in like the top 40-30% income earner in order to be able to afford something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have like, you know, the lowest income to the, you know, the highest limit of sort of workforce housing. I actually personally know people who have moved into that development. They've lived there now for over 10 years, and it really transformed their lives. It's rent stabilized forever.
Wow.
And by the way, it took a small army of people to execute that project. There were multiple delays, and we were up against a really tight timeline to lease up the building and get it to stabilize.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a team. It was like a well-oiled machine.
Right.
It was a great team. And I was, you know, my role sort of filled many different buckets. I was coordinating with the leasing folks to get them to really understand how quickly to get people into these units. I was coordinating with the development team who was coordinating with construction to figure out which units should we TCO first.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a huge logistical exercise. The other interesting thing about it is that it was the most number of applicants that had ever applied to housing in the history of the program. So that project got 92,000 applicants.
For how many units total?
For 925 apartments.
Wow.
And Jessica, that is the size of the city of Albany in New York. Okay.
And that's the capital.
And we had to take that data. And the city has very specific rules of how you treat that information. You have to take that data and you have to organize it in such a way that people who live in the community get first dibs.
Mm-hmm.
People who are handicapped also have a priority in leasing. People who are municipal employees also get a priority in getting these apartments before the general population. So we had to run through all of these different tasks, you know, to sort of prioritize the tenants, the applicants, to get them into the door, to qualify them and get them into those apartments. In addition to the logistical exercise of trying to deliver units from construction at a specific time frame,
mm-hmm.
to meet the timeline that we were trying to get to. To me, it was truly, again, like this well-oiled machine, a team. Everybody was communicating with one another, you know, and ultimately I think the developers who worked on this were really happy with the result. The developer, so one of the lead developers was a gentleman by the name of Frank Monterisi, who was a veteran. And at the end of the leasing, he issued all of us these like two-sided coins called challenge coins. It's something that was a part of, it was a part of like his military team. And like when they were all part of a mission together, they all had these coins that sort of reminded them of the mission that they all served on. Mm-hmm. And he made those custom for all of us to sort of remind us that we all went through the trenches to get this deal done. Really, really my favorite part. You could tell I'm excited just talking about it. It was a great project.
No, that's super cool. And I mean, that's a testament to several things. I mean, like you said, it's a well-oiled machine. All these transformative, like super large projects, they take like a small army of people for it to come together, not just within the organization that's the developer, but a partnership with NYCHA, with Housing Finance Agency, with, you know, all the different vendors that are involved in the construction and the building of the property. So people don't know all it takes to go behind the scenes to build these. And then it also is a testament to like, there's never enough affordable housing that can be built in New York. There's such a large demand. It's almost like a never ending wait list for people that want these apartments. So
yeah, and I have to give shout outs to HPD and HDC. They were the two agencies involved to really help bring this across the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So I want to transition from that because you worked with several large institutions. Then what made you decide to kind of go off and want to work at a boutique firm where you got a small team and you're kind of doing, you know, a million different things yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's a number of things. I really, really value the time that I spend at the places where I worked. I tell people all the time, you know, working at a large institution and really dedicating the time to it is a real education. So I feel like, you know, my time at Related and my time at Rose Companies, I feel like the people at these organizations really helped raise me. Mm-hmm. And help develop my personal skill set as an investment professional. So, you know, that time was incredibly important. But I think what happens is, as a leader, you start to come full cycle. Mm-hmm. And you want to do something that's a little bit more entrepreneurial.
Right.
So, you know, when Austin Walker called me and said, look, I've got this great opportunity to create impact, to invest in multifamily, to invest alongside diverse and emerging operators, and really build the business from the ground up, I said, sign me up.
Awesome.
Right? Because I had, you know, I had taken the time to really grow my body of work as an investment professional. And I really felt like I could really give, you know, I could wear all the different hats that is required when you're a small firm. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be, you know, you have to be investment, you have to, you know, look at debt, and you have to think about personnel issues and think about insurance issues. And we're also closing a private equity fund and closing into those and getting through SEC regulations and registrations. There's a lot of different hats. It's a great learning experience and a great growth opportunity. And I was really at a place in my life where I was looking for a real growth opportunity.
Absolutely. So let me back up for a second, because there may be some people out there that don't know what private equity is when it comes to real estate. So, you know, the companies that you worked with before, they were often the developer or the owner operator. Where does private equity in a firm like yours kind of come into play in the mix of getting development projects or value add multifamily projects done?
Well, if you think about how projects are typically financed and executed. Mm-hmm. So just to take a step back, I had always been in the shoes of the developer, sponsor, operator.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who do all the day-to-day work, make all the day-to-day decisions about everything that happens in the investment. But they also have partners. And oftentimes these are capital partners. These are people who bring money to the table and believe in the business plan and believe in their sponsor's ability to execute. So they provide capital to achieve a certain result, typically based on the acumen of that sponsor. Right. And so I've gone from being like the person in the day-to-day decision making shoes to the investor. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, the difference between being a developer and being, you know, a private equity investor. And sometimes, by the way, you know, the person providing a majority of the capital can be a co-operator with right. the sponsor. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes they operate in a way that facilitates the developer to continue to be in the driver's seat. And that's part of what it is that we do at our firm. Our capital is structured so that we can empower developers to be in the driver's seat. And we use our collective experience as a resource for them to lean on when they come across challenging issues or need support in executing their business plan. I kind of call it being an active LP. Mm-hmm. But our role is to be more of a capital allocator, less of a day-to-day decision maker, but really a resource tool for people as they're executing their business plans.
Got it. So since you all are a smaller firm, I'm assuming that you guys can be a little bit more nimble. You can be a little bit more, I guess, subjective on the criteria of what you invest in compared to, let's say, a larger hedge fund or one of these pension funds or something like that. So can you tell me about, I guess, the kind of differences of how you look at a deal versus one of those larger players and how they would evaluate a deal?
You know, that's a good question. In looking at and evaluating whether or not to move forward on a transaction, there's a lot of different things involved. It's not just the particular transaction and how it's underwritten, but it's about the sponsor and who it is that we're working with. I think the really important thing and the major difference is that we try not to live in a box, mm-hmm. and how we structure our investment in these transactions. And it's very different from how a lot of other people operate. Some people can just issue a term sheet. They're like, okay, this is our box. It's got to be between 5 and 10 million. These are the hurdles. This is the asset type and a number of other attributes. And if you sort of fit that box, then we can sort of work from there and we'll structure our thing as conventional LP or, you know, debt or whatever it is that their box might be. Mm-hmm. But what we try to do is really start by having a conversation with sponsors with what it is that they're trying to achieve. So, you know, is your goal to hold this for 5 years, for 10 years? Are there particular hurdles or, you know, financing strategies that just don't work for you for one reason or another? Are there other investors in your investor pool that you have to service and that may have certain requirements? And we try to structure our equity in a way that meets everybody's needs.
Right.
So, you know, some things make sense as conventional LP equity. Some things make sense as pref. You know, sometimes maybe it's just, you know, mezz or bridge equity to get you to another business plan. But we really try to work with sponsors in a way that facilitates them being able to execute their vision. And I really think that's like the biggest difference. And by the way, we play in the small and mid-market space. Mm-hmm. So if you need a check for $1 million or $5 million or $7 million, this is the perfect place for us to play. Most large institutions have fairly large investment requirements, so it pushes you to the much larger deal sizes. So we're able to serve a very different clientele because of that.
And another kind of feather in your cap or tool in your toolbox is that you guys are a correspondent lender. So can you talk to people about what that means, if, you know, someone doesn't know what that means? And then also, how does that kind of help you kind of control or evaluate the capital stack on both sides, debt and equity, when you're looking at deals?
Look, we try to be like part of the conversation around efficiency comes with, you know, is there a way for us to be like a 360 capital shop?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where that was born out of. The correspondent lender just means that we have an agreement where we can originate and source loans, whether it's agency, Fannie, Freddie, HUD, or structured finance products, pref, mez, under our name, but that loan is ultimately serviced and securitized by somebody else on the back end.
Right.
So the correspondent relationship is sort of an intermediary relationship because we want our sponsors to have a seamless experience. You're talking to us about financing. You might have initially reached out about equity, but you know, we have an incredible amount of leverage on the back end to negotiate great terms mm-hmm. for the sponsor, to reduce friction in the transactions, to reduce costs in the transaction. And ultimately, it just leads to greater value to everybody across the board.
Absolutely. Hopefully be the one-stop shop wherever possible.
One-stop shop. That's it. You know, we always tell people like, look, everybody comes to us with their existing relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I think until you actually transact together, you really start to understand the benefits of doing it this way. And we have a couple of transactions that we're working through where we're doing this sort of, you know, 360 capital.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, you know, I'm really excited to see those come full circle.
All right. And so you guys also kind of position yourself as an impact investing fund. Tell me what that means as far as, like, I guess how you're evaluating a deal different than your cookie cutter, you know, run of the mill private equity firm that's mostly concerned just with the bottom line only.
So that's a great question. I think today there's a lot of controversy around impact and ESG. So, you know, without specifically branding ourselves as an impact fund, because there's a lot of things and baggage that come along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Our focus is to be able to partner with emerging and diverse operators on a JV basis in their real estate transactions. That's sort of the core of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening to both myself and Austin Walker, who's the founder of the firm, along the way, we'd met a lot of really great people, developers, sponsor people who had had illustrious careers working real estate or have had, you know, family legacy of owning land, of owning real estate, or have had construction companies and are starting to build their own development pipeline. But we were limited in how we could work with them, right? Mm-hmm. As a developer at a large shop, unless we were working on a deal together specifically, we really didn't have a path to do business together. Or, you know, if you're originating a loan, you've originated the loan, but you don't really have a path to add more value to what it is that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And we're really finding that there was a need for that. You know, our clients and partners and people that we'd known were communicating to us that they needed to have more than just, a developer partner here that was sort of in a silo or just a debt partner, but really like an all around partner.
Yep.
So that's really where the idea was born. And the goal is to help developers scale their businesses. You know, typically, if you have a transaction and you need $3 million, you have to go out and syndicate that from 20, 30, You've done these before, right? Like how many people, 30, 40 people?
Mm-hmm.
It can be extremely challenging. And it could be the difference between doing one or two deals a year to being able to scale and do 5-6 deals a year,
right?
So we really wanted to be the difference maker. And that's the impact mm-hmm. aspect of our fund. We'd like to be able to look back and say, here's a cohort of 5 or 6 different people that we started to work with in 2023. And here we go, 3 funds later or 5 funds later in 2030. And this is how these people's businesses have grown. These are the number of transactions that we've been able to do together. These are the returns we've been able to return, returns to investors. And that's the difference between having to do deal by deal syndication and having a programmatic partner mm-hmm. that you do deals with.
Right. So very much relationship based.
Yeah. Real estate is a relationship based business. It just is what it is. And it's just so worth it for all of us to spend the time to not just getting to know new people, but like refining and like keeping up with existing relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody who's in the industry who really understands this is doing the same. And so by nurturing a particular relationship, you suddenly have access to other potential relationships. And you know this, Jessica, because we all have a network. You know, what do you need? Do you need to get to know someone? Maybe I have an intro to give to you. Right. And that intro really works just by virtue of the person who's making the referral and having some trust there.
Yep.
And you know, that's part of the value that we want to provide to people too. It takes a network to be able to manage the landscape of capital in real estate finance and investments. And we hope to be able to leverage our own in that way to support our developer partners.
And I imagine, you know, it eliminates some headaches, some variables if you're working with, you know, your core 5 or 6 sponsors, as you mentioned, and you grow and scale with them, eliminates some of the variables of having to underwrite new people, form new relationships, figure out how they work and all their nuances and everything like that. And so you're mostly focusing on each transaction moving forward, as opposed to just, you know, trying to develop new relationships with new sponsors.
Yeah. And I think it's really important for people to know that because look, it's not everything that we can invest in. We have to be really thoughtful about asset allocation, right? Mm-hmm. Assessing risk across our portfolio. And that's just allocation across sponsors and across geographies, across product types, from new construction to existing multifamily. And so getting to know people and underwriting them, again, this is a people business. Mm-hmm. And part of this is investing in people. The people are the ones who have to be on the ground every day and rehab the buildings and manage security issues and work with tenants and do rent collection, provide compliance services, all of the things that's necessary in order for an asset to be successful. So, you know, demonstrating the ability to be able to do some of those things, because I don't want to say that, I don't think it's fair to say that we'll rely on the same group of people, because we want to give a lot of great talented people the opportunity to do what they do best.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a huge part of making an investment decision, the people behind the business.
So are there any projects that you all are working on funding or have funded that you care to talk about?
Well, we get a lot of stuff going on, and that's the exciting thing. Like, we just launched in January. We hopefully will get to a fund closing, our initial fund closing at the end of June. And we have multiple term sheets out that we hope to close simultaneously.
Nice.
So we are very busy. We've also underwritten close to $500 million in transactions. since our doors open. And that's with a very slim group of people. So we're very, very busy. And I hope to tell you a lot more very soon.
All right. Stay tuned. So that's all with the firm. But what about Victoria personally? Is there anything that you're personally looking at to invest in?
Well, when I have the time, I had an idea the other day. We've been thinking a lot about opportunity zones and how to really utilize the program. I think it could be very challenging just because, you know, the time period is sort of lapsed when you can capture your step bases from the original legislation. You do have the benefit of the tax-free exit, but you have to find the right asset. It's very, very difficult to do in a commingled fund. So separate vehicles have to be formed for it. So it's just been very challenging. But I thought to myself, you know, if I had a, you know, some of my own personal money, I'd find like a strip mall in a gray area in an opportunity zone. An underutilized strip mall, that is, right? That's not serving anybody anymore. And because you could probably get it at a great basis, and that would build some great workforce housing. That's what I would do.
That's a simple enough play. It's just a matter of finding the right strip mall, the right environment, the right city, all that kind of stuff.
It's just a matter of small obstacle.
Right. All right, so what else is next for you, either personally or professionally?
Well, look, I have a lot of work to do. So that's really what's next for me. I have a lot of work to do. We have a fund that we're hoping will be very successful, because if it's successful, then that's a lot more impact that we can make. We are very close to closing on a majority of the commitments that we set out to have for this fund. So that's really the great thing. We're working towards closing a handful of other transactions. And we are, you know, very busy meeting new people and really launching the business. So, you know, what's next for me is
more of the same.
We're all hustling, Jess.
Yes. Well, you are a very popular person. Like, since I've met you, I've like come across several people that are like, oh yeah, Victoria, like she's that girl. So you're a very sought after person. So I appreciate you taking this time to come and, you know, talk all about your business and all the great projects that you guys have working on. So this was awesome. But I want to transition now to the last segment of the show here, because I can keep this conversation going on forever. Yeah. But the last segment is called The Fabulous Four. And it's four questions I ask every guest. So, you know, nothing too pressure. So the first question is, what is your favorite book about real estate?
There are a lot of really great books. There's two that really stick out for me. So the first is a book that I was forced to read. So Jonathan Rose bought everybody at the firm a copy of the book, Evicted. Mm-hmm. I think, what's it called? It's Evicted. I think if you Google Evicted, Poverty and Profit, it's about, it followed the lives of a number of people in Milwaukee, just kind of talking about poverty and eviction, and landlords and how they sometimes abuse the system. It's a great story. And I believe he gave us the book just to help us really identify with the work that we were doing. It was the preservation fund, affordable housing preservation fund. And we were looking to build and preserve workforce housing, high quality housing throughout the country. And it really resonated with me. It kind of helps you understand the story of what some people go through and looking for housing in secondary and tertiary markets all over the country. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a good book if you're interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've heard of that for sure.
You've heard it? Okay, yeah. And I think that the author is writing a follow-up book to it. The second book is not a real estate book at all, but whenever people ask me about books, I always reference it because it had a huge impact on me. Mm-hmm. Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. Mm-hmm. Malcolm Gladwell has a bunch of books that he's written. Outliers was the first of the many that I personally read. And it really gave me a perspective about what it takes for certain people to be successful in business. And it actually ties into why diversity in real estate is very important. There's a section of it that talks about cultural legacies, which is that your culture and customs and your parents and the challenges that you had to overcome to get to where you are have a huge impact in the decisions that you make, how you look at money, how you look at investments, and how you're ultimately a steward of other people's money. Mm-hmm. And that's why you need a diversity of these types of experiences in an investment environment. The same way that you would diversify your assets, you should diversify the experience of the people who are executing your investments, because you'll have a different assessment of risk. You'll have, just a completely new perspective to get you to the place of being successful with that investment. It's a great book.
Yeah, no, I've definitely read it, but I love the point that you made about it because, you know, in these days and times, everything is about diversity and inclusion. And some people look at it from just checking a box. We need more people of color. We need more women in the C-suite or on the board or what have you. But it's really to the point that you're making, like having that diverse background, those diverse experiences in your life leading up to this point is really what affects the bottom line, not just because I'm Black and I'm a woman. It's because of all the experiences I had as a Black woman that make how I think about something different than you. So...
Correct. I mean, like, we could even go further down that point. Like, just the function of being Black is not enough, right? Because there's different experiences. You know, I grew up in the Caribbean, mm-hmm. right? I was born here. I went to Haiti as a kid. I came back in middle school. So I came back having to learn English all over again, right? Mm-hmm. So English is kind of my second language. And, you know, we lived in a place where we all had to live together, like intergenerational living. I had to pay my way through college and grad school, right? And still along the way, be passionate about what I'm doing and wake up every day and have a lot of enthusiasm and gusto for what it is that I'm doing. All of those things are unique. Mm-hmm. To me, but you know, other people may have different experiences as well. So it's like you really have to look at someone through a lens of who are they and where do they come from and what have they overcome versus, you know, what do you look like, right? Or what school you went to.
Yep, for sure. All right. So second question here is, what advice would you give to your younger self when you just got started with real estate?
Oh, girl. speaking of college, I really reflect on my time at Fordham. So I went to Fordham University, which I went to the Bronx campus. I was between the Bronx and the Manhattan campus. I was also working at the same time and had a ton of extracurriculars going on. I was one of those students that showed up to class, went to class and left and went out in the world and sort of lived my life. I really would have advised my younger self to take the time to have a real college experience and take the time to nurture those relationships, the people that I was meeting on campus, to join clubs. And it's just to generally spend more time in that environment. Mm-hmm. As I come out into the world and you look at your peers, many of them have developed really strong relationships with peers that they went to college with. and who have may have ended up in the same industry. And just, you know, this, the power of your personal network, and college is a time to nurture and grow your personal network. And I was doing that, and I was doing it outside of college, mostly in a very different way. I sort of had a career I was starting to grow, but I definitely would have gone back and taken the time, slowed things down a little bit more, you know, put off the work for probably another year or two, and spend the time having like a real college experience.
Absolutely. I feel like a lot of people need to hear that, especially in these days and times. Like, it's so much pressure to like, what's nexting you to death. Like, you start, you got to know exactly what you want to major in. What's going to be your internship for the summer? What are you going to do, you know, to impress this person? Are you attending all these events? So it's a lot.
Like, just to like enjoy, like go to the clubs, join a sorority, join like, you know, the annual ice cream spring fest, right? Like whatever it is that they decide to do. And actually, you know, when I went to Fordham, they didn't have a real estate program, so I couldn't really get a real estate education. In fact, the business school has changed. It's called the Gabelli School of Business now. It used to be it's CBA, College of Business Administration. They used to call it the Coloring Book Academy. It's a very different time, but now they have a real like real estate program there. There's a lot of alumni who go back. And so I'm finding new opportunities to get involved today. But I wouldn't have to play so much catch up if I did, you know, if I really spent the time while I was there.
For sure. Okay. So the third question here is, what topic within real estate do you personally want to learn more about?
I think there's always so much more that you could learn about real estate and just real estate adjacent, you know, professions and practices. One thing that comes to mind for me is student housing. It's not really an asset class that I've had exposure to. You know, there's something about the transient nature of the tenant base, and how like the capital markets sort of view that and treat that when they're financing these types of transactions. Mm-hmm. I would love to understand those nuances a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a new asset class today. There's a lot of institutional investment in student housing. I would just love to understand it a little bit more.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a booming market, especially if you can get one involved where it has like it's sponsored directly by the school that it's adjacent to, as opposed to being like independent. Like if you have a contract that it's a dormitory rather than just another apartment building in the area of a university.
Yeah, I wondered how that works too. In fact, you know, at Fordham University, there's a ton of off-campus housing. Mm-hmm. Some of it would actually say Fordham University off-campus housing. Mm-hmm. And some of it would just be in the same vicinity, but look like it's generally privately owned. Mm-hmm. It's all very interesting. So I'd love to, if you know anybody in the student housing space, I'd love to have coffee with them and learn a little bit more.
Okay.
Yeah. Have an intro.
You know me, I'll be like, oh yeah, I got somebody next week.
yes, set up an intro. I love it.
All right, cool. So the last one, not really a question, but can you please give a shout out to another woman in real estate?
There are so many people that I would want to give a shout out to.
Go ahead.
And I'm just so worried about leaving anybody out. But there's a handful that stand out.
Okay.
The first is the people who hired me and spent a lot of time with me at Related. It's a woman named Vera Silver. She's a mentor and a friend, very talented. She taught me everything I knew about affordable housing compliance, gave me a lot of great advice along the way. along with a group of other women that I worked with, Linda Thiemann, who's a friend of mine who worked with us at the Affordable Housing Group, Lynn Sylvester, who was the head of training, just a lot of great women. Tammy Vakos, who was the head of Region 9 at Related, she sort of ran the luxury housing division on the management side, and really saw her do some great things, you know, in the luxury management part of the company. So I learned a lot just from watching these people. Mm-hmm. So that's a shout out there. I'd also give a shout out to Caroline Vary at Jonathan Rose Companies. She was one of the few women at the firm who just sort of wakes up every day and, yeah, she's passionate about what she does. And, you know, I learn a lot from her as well. So I give her a shout out as well.
All right. That's quite an all-star team there you just named. So shout out to those ladies. Appreciate you.
Yep. So many others.
All right. So how can people get in touch with you if they want to continue this conversation with you?
Yeah. Hit me up on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way to get in touch with me. I check it every day. You know, if you want to post my email address, that'd be great. So email, LinkedIn is a great way to find me. I try to do a great job of also posting when we're at various conferences and there's an opportunity to meet. So just, you know, check us out.
Awesome. Yeah. Victoria's like, where's Waldo? She's everywhere.
I'm trying to cover a lot of ground, Jess.
Yes, you are. Like I said, everyone knows you. You're a very sought after and, you know, very popular person these days.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And I appreciate you really, you know, allowing me to speak on your platform and, you know, just sort of being a part of what you're doing. Congratulations on having this podcast and just really like covering just so many different aspects of what women are doing in real estate, you know, from hotel to title to asset management. And, you know, you've talked to, you know, everybody across the spectrum. So that's really, really cool.
Oh, I think you appreciate those kind words. I'm just out here trying to, you know, just spread the word, basically do what I wish someone had done for me. Like, I wish I would have known about all these different lanes in real estate, you know, many, many years ago. So I appreciate that.
Yes, for sure.
All right. So lastly, any last words of wisdom for people?
Last words of wisdom, you know, just be good to other people. Don't be judgmental. Listen more than you speak. I think if you can do some of those things, you'll learn a lot, and you'll be better off for it.
Amen to that. Well, Victoria, you're the best. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all your wisdom, all these gems with us. Like I said, this is definitely one of my favorite episodes now. So I really appreciate you for taking the time.
Of course, anytime. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So this is another episode of the Pretty Girls Love Real Estate podcast. Thank you to my guest, Miss Victoria Goose, A Walker & Co. Hit her up. You know, follow all the great things she's got going on. And we will catch you on the next one. Thank you.